A Biblical Theory of Sexuality, the second talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 5, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I would maintain that you can't have a biblical theory of sexual intimacy without talking about marriage. Last week, Larry talked about marriage and explored God's purposes for marriage. I thought did a good job of exploring what, from God's point of view, the real ultimate purpose of marriage was, and so answered the question of what is marriage from that perspective. I want to take a slightly different angle on it because it will tie into our topic for tonight. But let me just make the case before I do that. If you were to go down here to the university, the anthropological approach to sexuality would, and marriage for that matter, would be that the given in human experience is sexuality. And marriage is simply a device, a human construct, a human invention, that we human beings use to control and channel and govern and otherwise limit the expression of our sexuality. So for modern secular people, sexuality is the fact and is the given, and marriage is simply a cultural invention and artifact. I would argue from a biblical perspective it's exactly the opposite. Not exactly the opposite, but roughly the opposite. That the given from the biblical perspective is this relationship called marriage. And God gave us the gift of human sexuality, which is not to be mistaken with animal sexuality. I mean, one of the things that ought to drive us crazy is looking to the animal kingdom for lessons on how to be sexual. Because human sexuality is an entirely different phenomenon than animal sexuality, as should become clear as the course goes on. But from a biblical perspective, this unique, strange relationship called marriage is the given. And God gave us the gift of human sexuality as a means of expressing, promoting, and otherwise enhancing the relationship. So it's exactly the opposite of the anthropological approach. So with that in mind, I mean, keep in mind that from a biblical point of view, God is a rational God who created a rational universe. God is a rational God who had purposes in mind for what he did, what he created, and what he causes to be, all fits into some coherent picture of what he wants to accomplish and what he wants to result. Well, what God had in mind for human beings is man and woman to come together in a unique kind of relationship, a unique kind of commitment to one another. That's the more important and prior reality. Sex, sexual intimacy, simply serves the needs and purposes of that commitment and that relationship. With that in mind, then, we need to back up then. If sex, sexual intimacy, serves the purposes of that relationship, what is that relationship and how does sex relate to that? And that's what we need to talk about. I forgot my Bible, but I think I can do this from memory. In the opening chapters of Genesis, you have the creation account. God creates male and female in the second creation account. And when he creates woman out of the man, the comment that gets made is, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. That seems to be Moses or whoever the author of that statement's commentary is on the narrative of the creation of woman. He's making a theological deduction based on what God has done, he's drawing theological conclusions about the relationship between man and woman. And it seems to me that it's the closest thing that we have in the Bible to an actual out-and-out definition of marriage. The marriage relationship is where a man leaves his father and mother, and then there are two things. He cleaves to his wife, and leaving father and mother and cleaving to his wife is one, and becoming one flesh is the second aspect of the relationship. So let me just talk about that for a second. Leaving father and mother and cleaving to his wife seems to suggest that the nature of the marriage relationship, the nature of the marriage commitment, is that a person is committing himself, a man is committing himself to his wife to make her that human being above whom he has no other human loyalty. I mean, divine loyalty is one thing, loyalty to God and the things of God is one thing, but as human beings are concerned, in the marriage relationship, a husband is committing himself to his wife that no other human being will receive greater loyalty from him than she does. Now, I just think it makes perfect sense that the author there is intending this to be mutual and reciprocal. The same is true of the woman. The woman is giving her highest loyalty to her husband. No other human being will have higher loyalty than her husband. It's very interesting that given that, and given that it's a mutual relationship, it's very interesting coming out of the times in which that had to have been written, that he would say a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, rather than a woman will leave her father and mother and cleave to her husband, because it's very contrary to the practice of that culture. Most of those cultures, the woman would be taken from her family and would become a part of the husband's family and tribe. So for him to say a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife is a very powerful way in that culture of talking about the mutuality of the loyalty that they are committing themselves to. It's not just the woman that becomes loyal to the husband. That would have been culturally taken for granted. But the husband must leave the father and mother in order to cleave to his wife. So there's this mutual commitment to one another. In the marriage commitment, I'm saying to my wife, I will keep you unique. No one will hold a higher place than you. And I reserve the most intimate knowledge of myself to give to you and to you alone. No one else will have that place in my life. The second thing that he mentions there, and the two will become one flesh, I think is a commitment to so completely and totally intertwine our lives with one another that it is as if we are sharing one life experience together rather than living two life experiences in parallel to each other. It's the one fleshness, I think, is intending to talk about the complete and total sharing of our lives. Flesh, oftentimes in both Greek and Hebrew, the word we translate flesh in Greek and Hebrew, oftentimes is a word that's used to simply talk a life lived in this physical age, in the here and now under the sun. A life lived here and now is a flesh. And I think that's the sense in which it's used here. To become one flesh is to become one life experience, a shared life experience together. So it's a promise to have a complete giving and sharing of ourselves. All that I am and all that I have belongs to you is the promise I'm making in marriage. Just one last comment. We could talk a whole lot about both of those things, but our topic is not marriage, it's sex, so I want to get on. But it is important, I think, to notice, unlike the way some people might be inclined to take that statement, it's not a statement of metaphysical fact. It's not that when you get married, you automatically, by virtue of the marriage relationship, become one flesh and have left father and mother. That's the promise that we're making. It's the moral obligation I'm taking on. It's the duty I'm taking on. So it's something that we spend the rest of our life, in a sense, working at to leave all other human loyalty behind and to completely share my life with my wife or husband. I can fail at that. I can fail to keep my promise or to not keep it fully. And to that extent, I'm not doing justice to the oath that I took and to the commitment that I've made. But there's nothing automatic and necessary about it. It's simply what it is that I'm promising to do. And that's one of the reasons why, as Larry was talking about last week, as hard as marriage can be, and as treacherous as it can be to enter into this relationship and do it right and make it work, that's nonetheless, it's a very rewarding relationship. And I think the reason it's so rewarding is because what we are promising to one another meets deep psychological and emotional needs in a way that no other relationship could. I mean, if you think about it, if somebody is promising to me that no other human being is going to be more important to them than I am, that strikes a pretty deep chord in us to be cherished and treasured and important and valuable to somebody else. So if a person follows through on their commitment and keeps their promise, it's a very rewarding, emotionally, psychologically rewarding relationship to be in, on the one hand. When they don't keep their promise, it's a devastating failure. The incredible, profound sense of betrayal and emptiness that results when someone who's promised that doesn't carry through on that. That's the danger and the potential benefit of marriage. Okay, so what's going on with sexual intimacy and sex? And I've argued that sex serves the purposes and is an aid, if you will, to this marriage commitment. In what sense? What do I mean by that? Well, the most important thing, I think, to understand about sex from a biblical perspective is that sex is a sort of natural language. And this is a crucial concept, so I need to define it. In the Gutenberg curriculum, one of the philosophers we read is Thomas Reid, the Scottish common sense philosopher. And he's the one who developed the concept of a natural language, or at least employs it most effectively in his philosophy. He means it not in the sense of sexuality, but just the five senses that as we normally use them in perception. And his contention is that, for example, when I rub my fingertips across the texture of the, whatever this is, stand, music stand here, there's a particular sensation in my fingertips. That sensation, in effect, speaks to me and tells me what the texture of this stand is. When I walk into a room and I smell that fragrance, the fragrance of a rose, there's nothing about the fragrance that resembles a rose, but everything about the fragrance is telling me, I'm here, little old Rosie here, you know, look for me. It's speaking to me of the presence of this particular object. And it's that fragrance that means there's a rose. Certain sounds mean what they mean. And Reid argues, I think quite compellingly and quite successfully, that my sense experience, my senses are given to me by God to be receptors of a kind of information coming from the world that allows the world to speak to me about itself, the external world. That's sort of the idea that I have in mind here, although there's certain important differences, because I'm arguing that what I'm arguing is that God has so designed us, has so designed our psyches, male and female, that sexual intimacy is a kind of language of our bodies, that with my body, I can speak to the body of my spouse. And in speaking the language of the body, I am saying something very, very specific and very particular. Namely, what I would argue is that with the language of my body, of sexual intimacy, I am saying to my wife or husband, let me back up in order to make sense of this. I would argue that our psyches are so built that there is a kind of equation, psychological equation, between my body and myself, and particularly between the sexual part of my body, my genitals in particular, that part of my body that seems intimate to me, the parts of my body that I am modest about. Why am I modest about them? Because they are more profoundly me. They are more deeply me than the rest of me. And unless I'm prepared to give of myself or reveal myself, I'm inclined to not disclose those parts of my body. Well, why would that be? You know, why would we be modest about some parts of our body and not other parts of our body, unless there's something built into our psyche? Some people would argue from culture, not from nature, but wherever it comes from, I have learned, my psychology has been built to equate certain parts of me as more intimately me than other parts of me. Well, in sexual intimacy, I give another human being knowledge of that intimate part of me, of my anatomy. I disclose to them me. And what is what God naturally intended to happen is when I disclose that intimate part of me, it's a way of saying, you may know me in my, know me spiritually. That is, you can know my person, you can know my soul, you can know my fears, you can know my desires, you can know my weaknesses, you can know my secrets, you can know my dreams. There is, if I will not withhold my body from you, then there is nothing that I will withhold from you. And that's what I'm arguing, is the language of our bodies. That is, by being intimate physically, I am in fact meaning to say to the other person that all of me is open to you to know. Now, obviously, I can lie. I can give you my body and not let you know me. But if I'm right, if God intended this to be a natural language, then when I give you my body, then I am promising you full disclosure, if you will. And when I don't follow through with full disclosure, I have lied to you. I have made a false promise with the language of my body. The other aspect of this natural language, I think, is that because from a biblical point of view, sex is intended to be for one and only one person, monogamy, uniqueness, that by giving you my body and no one else my body, not allowing anyone to be intimate with me in the same sort of way, it becomes a very apt way of communicating to the other person, no one else has, to no one else am I committed with this sort of loyalty. You are absolutely unique. You and only you will I allow to know me this intimately. So in that way then, sexual intimacy in a monogamous relationship then is a way of saying to my spouse, everything that I am and everything that I have belongs to you. If I will not withhold my body, there is nothing I will withhold from you. And secondly, you are absolutely unique in my life. To you and only to you am I committed in this way, and do I give myself in this way. So in that context then, the physical body becomes the means by which I can say, in a way that words can't as dramatically and poignantly express, I belong to you and only you are special to me. Now, I would argue that's not a meaning that we impose on our sexuality. It's a meaning that is inherent within our sexuality. I don't think we can help ourselves. That is what we mean in sexual intimacy. If you look at the poems, the literature, the song lyrics, the stuff that we keep exploring in various forms of art, a theme that you find, I usually find it in country western, but a theme that you usually find is something along the lines of, you know, we met in a bar and we agreed together, we promised each other, you know, we like signed a contract, and both of us signed the contract saying, when we have sex, we don't mean anything by it. And then the next line is, so why do I feel like I do this morning? I agreed that it wasn't going to mean anything. Why am I having such a hard time thinking that you didn't promise me something. Well, my contention would be because we did promise something. We may not have meant to promise something. We may have made a conscious, deliberate, purposive decision to try to make sex meaningless. But the problem is, sex is not meaningless and cannot be made meaningless. Now, I think it is probably the case that people can batter their psyche to submission and can so brutalize their own psyche that they become utterly callous toward any meaning that sexuality has. I think you see people who have done that. But they have only done that by brutalizing, literally brutalizing their psyche and truly making themselves into callous individuals. It's not a pretty picture. It's not the kind of thing that we want to do with our lives. Okay, you may be asking, are you making all this up, or is this really biblical? I've already argued that I think experience itself suggests this universal human experience, that we seem to be incapable of really taking the meaning out of sexuality. But there's another reason that I believe this, and it comes from the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 6, if you do have your Bible, you might want to look at it. But 1 Corinthians 6, verses 12 through 20. In some of your translations, it may not be quite as clear what he means. So I have my own translation here. I think this reflects accurately his argument. And if you have some questions about it, we can talk about it. But let me read it for you. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are of benefit. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food. And in the end, God will do away with both the one and the other. But the body is not for immorality. Rather, it is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Now, God has not only raised up the Lord, but he shall also raise us up through his power. Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who clings to the Lord is one in spirit with him. Flee from fornication. Every sin that a man might commit is a sin apart from the body, but the one who commits fornication commits a sin within his own body. Or do you perhaps not understand that your body is a temple of that Holy Spirit within you that you have from God? Indeed, you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. Accordingly, glorify God in your body. Now he starts, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are of benefit. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. That's a very particular argument that he's having with the people in Corinth. They're arguing that somehow we're no longer under law. Therefore, because we're no longer under law, we can do whatever we want to without restriction or something roughly like that. And that's what he's responding to. So when he says, all things are lawful for me, I think what he's saying is, well, okay, in a sense that's true technically. But when he says, but not all things are of benefit, he means that in a very strong sense, because in other places where he used similar kind of language, what he means by not being of benefit is not being of benefit to you to get you eternal life. That's what he means by that. So he's saying, well, there may be a technical sense in which all things are lawful, but some of these things that are lawful will damn you. So we need to be careful here. We need to be discerning about what it is that we're doing. That's, I think, the spirit within which he means it. Then he brings up the argument that he's having to combat. Food is for the stomach, and the stomach is for food, and in the end, God will do away with both the one and the other. That's the position, the argument of the people in Corinth who are arguing, I can go and sleep with anybody, anywhere, anytime, and it's not a problem. It's not a moral problem. It's not a spiritual problem. Look, it's just like eating, they're saying. We naturally have a need and a desire for food. Since we have a need and a desire for food, when we're hungry, we go eat. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. In fact, it isn't even relevant to morality and spirituality because it's just my body. And in the end, my body's going to die, my body's going to be gone, and what I am spiritually is the only thing that counts. The food in the stomach is going to be done away with, he says, or the argument goes. So Paul responds to that, and he responds to that point by point. They say food is for the stomach and the stomach is for food. He says, but the body is not for immorality. Rather, it is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Okay, well, what does he mean by that? Well, on the one hand, he's saying, okay, it's true. There's an analogy up to the point, up to a point between food and sex. We have a desire for food, and we have a craving for food. That's true. And we have a longing and a craving for sex. That's true. Both are biological desires. But the analogy breaks down there, he says, because even though we have a natural biological longing, God never gave us our bodies to use to express immoral deeds and immoral actions. Our bodies were not given to us for immorality. So whatever desires we might have always need to be understood and managed, if you will, governed in the light of the question of what is good and right and pure, what is moral. And just because I have a desire is not self-validating to the fulfillment of that desire. Some desires can't be satisfied without violating morality. And if they can't be violated without, if they can't be satisfied without violating morality, then we ought not to do them, because the body is not for immorality. The body is not for immorality, rather it is for the Lord. That is, the purpose of my body is to be used in service and obedience to my master, to the Lord. And the Lord is for the body. Can't remember how I took that exactly. The rightful role and place of our Lord is to be the master over the way we employ our bodies. That's his rightful place. That's his rightful role. Just as food's rightful role is to feed us when we're hungry, the Lord's rightful role is to be the master who dictates what are the limits and bounds of how we use our body. They say, in the end, God is going to do away with this, with your stomach and food, so it really doesn't even pertain to morality and spirituality. Paul says, no, God has not only raised up the Lord, but he shall also raise us up through his power. We will never be disembodied spirits, he's arguing. We are always going to have a body of one kind or another. We are always going to be embodied beings. And because that's the case, it will always be relevant to morality what we do with our bodies. It's not like we have these irrelevant appendages called bodies now that we're going to slough off and then get on with being who we are in our moral and spiritual purity. We will always have bodies, and it will always be relevant what we do with our bodies. Morality consists of rightly employing the resources of our bodies. That will always be the case. There is a resurrection of our bodies, just as there was a resurrection of the Lord. Okay, then he goes on. Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Exactly following up on that last point. It's not just my spirit that belongs to the Lord. My body belongs to the Lord. So don't you understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It says, the two shall become one flesh. Okay, first of all, we need to rightly understand what he's saying here. In a lot of English translations, you may even get the impression from my translation here, that his point is some kind of weird metaphysical point. You are one with God. Your juices and the juices of God are intermingled together, and you are one with God in some ontological, metaphysical space somewhere. So don't be taking the juices of God and be mingling them with the juices of a prostitute because, why? I don't know. just because you don't want to be doing that. I mean, that it can sound like that's what he's arguing. But there's nothing spooky and metaphysical about what he's saying here. What he's saying is, to be one with the Lord is to is to be owned by him, if you will, to be a servant to him. And one with him in spirit, as he's going to go on to say, I share his values, I share his priorities, I am committed to the goodness that he is and that he teaches and so on. And in that sense, I am what the apostles elsewhere call having koinonia with Jesus. I have all this in common with Jesus. Okay, given that I have all this stuff in common with Jesus, shall I take the members that belong to Jesus, the Messiah, and make them members promised to a prostitute? Now, why would that be a problem? Why would it be a problem to take the members that belong to Jesus and promise them to a prostitute? Is it also a problem to take the members that belong to Jesus and promise them to my wife? No, because that's not what he's concerned about here. Sex is not a problem to him. It's sex with a prostitute that's a problem to him. So why is it a problem? The problem is because by the very nature of who a prostitute is, I'm not going to make her my wife. I have no intention of making her my wife. I have no intention of living with her where I share my whole life with her, make her the most special person in my life, and am one with her. So I think what Paul is talking about here is the incongruity of being a person who belongs to Jesus. And a person who belongs to Jesus is a person, as Jesus teaches us in the Sermon on the Mount, let your yes be yes and your no be no. If you're going to be a disciple of mine, you are going to be an utterly and completely straightforward human being who does not lie, who does not defraud, and does not dissemble. What you say, you mean. What you promise, you do. You are simple-mindedly straightforward, if you will. You don't try to ever defraud anybody. Well, that's what it means to be one with me, is that you're committed to that sort of standard of what it means to be a human being. Well, how can you, who are one with the Lord, go and promise a prostitute what you have no intention of keeping? Making a promise to a prostitute that you have no intention of keeping. Those don't go together, he's saying. Those are completely incompatible realities. So, with that in mind, let me read it again. Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is one in body with her? It says, the two shall become one flesh. Now, if you go back to the Genesis account where it says the two shall become one flesh, he's not talking about sex there. He's talking about marriage there. He's defining the marriage relationship and the marriage commitment. So why is he using a statement in Genesis that is defining marriage to talk about having sex with a prostitute? The only thing that makes any sense is if his understanding of sex is that it is inherently the very meaning of sex with the prostitute that you are promising the one fleshness of marriage when you are intimate with her in that way. Then his argument makes sense. Otherwise, it's a completely nonsensical argument. But the one who clings to the Lord is one in spirit with him. Flee from fornication. I won't dwell on this any longer, but let me just read you a slightly different paraphrase of what he's saying. This is a paraphrase, but maybe it'll make it a little clearer. Do you not understand that your bodies are members that belong to the Messiah? Shall I then take members belonging to the Messiah and make them members promised to a prostitute? Of course not. Or do you not understand, perhaps, that the one who clings to a prostitute is promising to be one with her, with his body? It says the two shall become one flesh. But the one who clings to the Lord is one with him with regard to his spirit. Flee from fornication. Every sin that a man might commit is a sin apart from the fact that it involves the body. But the one who commits fornication is committing the sin within his own body. And I think the point that he's making there is just very simply that every sin that we commit involves the body, maybe in one way or the other, but only fornication is a sin that we commit with our body in the sense that we're actually lying and defrauding with our body. I think that's the sense in which he means that. I think the rest of this Ron will probably get into next week. So rather than cover his ground. Why don't we open it up for your questions and have a discussion about this?
Hey, Jack. Okay, so I'm 21 years old, and I have a long-standing relationship with a member of the opposite sex, and we've made what we consider to be lifetime commitment to each other. We intend to fulfill that commitment. Why does a piece of paper matter, legal marriage license and so forth, before we give ourselves physically to one another, because we already are giving ourselves in every other way to one another? Why does it matter?
Well, let me answer it this way. When I was a pastor at a church in California, the policy of the church was, if a couple comes to you and asks to be married by you as a pastor at this church, as a large pastoral staff, and they are living together, then you need to ask them to separate and live apart until the wedding. And that was not my rule. That was imposed by the board. There's a couple came to me, and I had a Bible study up on a hippie commune up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and this couple came to the Bible study. They were Christians. They claimed to be Christians, and they were living together. They had lived together for a number of years, and their perspective was that they had gone out one night and said their vows to one another on the point overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and they were married. She got pregnant, and when she got pregnant, they decided that they wanted to be legally married, so they came to me and asked me if I would legally marry them. So I was faced with this dilemma, because I knew them well enough. I worked in their community. I ate with them. I knew all the other hippies in the commune and how they related to each other. And it was very interesting, because everybody in the commune knew that you don't mess with Craig or Cheryl. They're with each other. Everyone else in the commune was swapping beds all the time. I mean, it was just standard practice it was a very promiscuous community. But this couple were together. So in that little microcosm of society, it wasn't just that Craig and Cheryl were saying that they had declared their lives to one another. Everybody seemed to know that. And everybody seemed to know that they were off limits. So it seemed really artificial to say to them, okay, well, you have to stop sleeping with each other until you get married, because they were as married as anybody else that I know in the context of their little counterculture and their little commune and society. So I decided I couldn't do that in their case, because it seemed to me that what was happening with them was not that they were deciding to get married. They had already got married several years ago, but they were deciding to make more complete what they had, completing the process of getting married that they had already made a reality several years earlier. And I applaud them for that. And notice what happened. They decided to make it legal when she got pregnant, because all kinds of issues come to play that become important now that are not so important when you're just young and don't have any responsibility and are relatively carefree. You have other human beings to take care of, and it makes all the difference in the world how the larger society around you is looking at you. I mean, part of what makes marriage marriage, we can't change the fact that it is a legal and social relationship. It's not just you and I know the commitment we've made to one another, but in marriage you're announcing to the whole society, we have this kind of relationship, and here are our intentions, and you stay away. I mean, you don't impinge upon this. So things like inheritance come to play, taxes and legal and civil responsibilities, all kinds of stuff are defined differently for people who are a couple rather than single. And what they were doing is simply, it's one thing to have the commune know that you're a couple. It's another thing to know, to let the United States of America know that you're a couple. And they recognized the importance of letting the whole United States of America know that they were a couple. So in my mind, in your scenario, it makes a lot of difference whether it's a real marriage that they have made somewhat foolishly and prematurely without giving due thought to the implications of what they haven't done, that so-called piece of paper. I mean, we can sneer at it as a piece of paper all we want, but the fact of the matter is it's that piece of paper that translates into absolute, complete, universal social sanction within our culture of what we've done. And the absence of that means, at best, our relationship is ambiguous in the eyes of society and, at worst, non-existent. So it may seem like, especially from the standpoint of the emotions of the relationship and the commitment and the personal existential aspect of the commitment, I mean, you're right. I mean, a person is right. The piece of paper doesn't make the personal existential commitment either more or less there. But that's not the point of the piece of paper. It's not to make the personal existential commitment real or authentic. It's to let the society at large, the legal structures, know where I stand. And so any marriage cannot help but be incomplete without that. Is it non-existent? Not necessarily. I think it depends on the people. But it's always foolish to disregard the importance of that. I'm not being loving to my wife if I marry her and don't bother to tell anybody else. I really am shortchanging her.
Jack, this sort of builds on to his question, but is there any validity in making an argument that our society has sort of like made the piece of paper seem a lot less valuable because a lot of people don't, I mean, they are married, but they don't necessarily keep their vows. I mean, is there?
Well, yeah, but it's not just the piece of paper they're making less valuable. They're actually doing damage to the marriage itself, not just the piece of paper. But yeah, to the extent that we get married and either explicitly or at least implicitly, I think this is important. By entering into the marriage relationship, we don't really even have an option with regard to how much we're promising, I would argue. I mean, marriage has a certain definition in the eyes of God and in the purposes of God. And to get married is to take on those responsibilities. So if I don't follow through on them, I'm not keeping the promise that I made. Even if I never spelled it out explicitly, implicitly, I'm making a certain kind of commitment. And to the extent that I don't follow through with that in practice, I don't respect my wife. I don't care for my wife. I am not good to my wife. If I fail in those respects, I am not keeping a promise that I had implicitly made. And I'm doing irreparable damage to the whole image of marriage.
So living in a society where many people fail to follow through that promise, what does that make the piece of paper look like to the society?
Just a meaningless legal fiction. Yeah.
No, I'm saying to a couple, like, why would a couple, you know, thinking, well, should we make it this legal thing? But why would we do that in a society which has made that piece of paper nothing by failing to?
Well, I mean, I think the fact is right. The culture has certainly not respected marriage the way that it is. I wouldn't buy the argument. It seems to me that the right thing to do is to make my marriage one of those that does honor marriage in the way that God intended, and that's the way to make my statement to society. It doesn't seem to me I'm making a very powerful statement to society if I just live together without getting married. I mean, what kind of statement is that?
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions.
Okay.
And the first question is not particularly profound. It's going to be rather weird. But you were talking about just like the significance of sexuality, and you were talking about like nudity and like the significance of revealing or like experiencing someone else's genitals. And I was just curious what you thought about a phenomenon like nudist colonies. So that's the weird part of the question. And like, I know that what happens there, I'm sure like probably a good third of it is people just want to see each other naked. And another third of it is probably people just like rebelling and say like, look, we can be naked and deal with it. But it seems that somewhere between those two extremes, there's something going on where people actually find it healthy and comforting and freeing to just be able to be who they are. And like, they get over these feelings of like low self-perception and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering what you thought about that and how that would contribute to your idea of sexuality.
Okay. Well, as background to my answer, I think it's important to know that sex is largely a head trip. It's largely a question of perception, imagination. I mean, even the sex act itself is, it's not really our bodies that make sex sex, it's our head that makes sex sex. And because that's the case, there's a lot of variables in what is sexual. Sexual intimacy can be a glance from across the room. So something as seemingly objectively innocent as that can be a deeply sexual act on the one hand. On the other hand, it seems to me that one could be acculturated into a culture where there is incredible immodesty with respect to the way we dress without there being anything sexual happening, because we simply are accustomed to the degree of nudity and can opt to not have that be sexual. So I don't know that I'm in a position to pass judgment one way or the other on cultural practices. I mean, just think about how relatively immodestly we accept dress in our culture as compared to many Islamic cultures, or even within our own culture and history. Back in, Jane Austen's day, to see a woman's bare ankle was immodest. Well, we've come a long way. But I'm not saying that there isn't a lot of sexual intimacy going on visually in our culture. It is going on, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, that we can be more revealing than someone else and be less sexual than some other culture. So did that make sense? So
yeah, I was wondering what you thought, if there is something going on that's not wrong within that context, and that people are actually experiencing something healthy, where they are, but it's not the sexual intimacy that you would have in a marriage. I was wondering what's going on there that is healthy that would fit with the biblical view of sexuality, if there is something. Not that you have to like encourage us all to go to nudist colonies or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I suppose. So your question is, if there's anything healthy going on, what might that be? I imagine the nice thing about a nudist colony is you it's probably hard in a nudist colony to take seriously the Platonic ideal form, body form of the model on all the magazines. That there's a lot of body variety in the world, and that's healthy. I mean, to realize that beauty and being appealing can come in a lot of different ways and a lot of different forms, that's something that our culture is deprived of, because we're just fed a constant stream of be this way and look this way, and this is what's sexy and this is what's hip and this is what's cool, instead of letting people be people. And I would imagine in a nudist colony, that's easier to accept. I'm reaching.
Yeah.
I'm trying hard.
My other question was, a lot of people talk about how you might have different views of sexuality or different ways of perverting it depending on your gender. You have like the so-called masculinization of sexuality, which focuses on pleasure, and then I guess the feminization would focus more on intimacy. I was wondering what you would say, what is the full and proper role of pleasure within the context of sexual intimacy in a marriage?
It's not the essence of what sexuality is. It's just a nice little delightful correlate that God created. And that becomes really important, because even within Christian marriages, and even within the sexual relationships within Christian marriages, for example, if we buy what the culture is constantly reinforcing in our thinking, then the whole point of sex is pleasure, and it becomes a pursuit of pleasure. It seems to me, I think that kills sexuality. Sexual experiences come in many, many different forms, in many, many different ways. What every sexual experience within marriage has in common is it's a celebration of the commitment. It's an expression of the commitment, a declaration of the commitment. And whether it is a really passionate experience or a relatively not passionate, quiet, gentle experience doesn't make any difference. And if sex, even within the context of marriage, becomes the quest for the ultimate orgasm, it misses the whole point. That's nice, but it's not the whole point and reason and purpose of sex. And one can only end up being dissatisfied with their sex life if they're on the quest for the ultimate orgasm and can't quite seem to pull it off. Because we'll never be able to pull it off. We'll never be able to have the kind of pleasure that we imagine having. Our imagination is boundless, and if we with our imagination, we define for ourselves this elusive goal of being really sexually satisfied, the result is going to be we're going to be very dissatisfied with our sex life. Whereas if we recognize that the real heart and soul and essence and purpose of sexuality is to simply be intimate with this person in a way that I am not intimate with anybody else, and to allow that to be a declaration of the uniqueness of that person and my commitment to that person, then that's easy to satisfy. I never miss on that one. And I can be totally satisfied.
If I completely understand how someone could overplay pleasure within the context of sexuality. But I could see someone also hearing this would definitely try to, like, would strive to not make that the central purpose and therefore make it hardly a purpose at all. And so I think my question was more, someone is focusing on intimacy, but they also want to give the full place to pleasure, meaning its proper place. What would be the extent to which that would be? That would have a place. I mean, is it just as you were saying, like, kind of a pleasant side effect, or is it actually supposed to be more central to it?
I like to liken it to a game like football, baseball, basketball, soccer, where if you make winning the purpose for the game, it's out of balance. I mean, the purpose of physical competition are the health benefits and money, important stuff like that. That's the purpose of them. But the strategy is always to win. The strategy of the competition is always to win. But even if you lose, the purpose for it being an institution in our society is still satisfied. Sex is the same way. The strategy in sex is always to give pleasure to the other person. But it's not the meaning of sex. But I think it can be and should be the strategy of sex. That's just the way I think it's designed. Yeah, sometimes because of the influence of the Victorian value system, it's not really the influence of Christianity, although Christianity gets blamed, but it's the Victorian sexual ethic that kind of basically made pleasure in and of itself immoral and sinful. Is wrong. It has nothing to do with the biblical sexual ethic. Nothing wrong with pleasure, as long as we let it just be what it is, namely, relatively unimportant. Fun, but unimportant.
Can I add to that? I think it also has to do with the way you're talking about the sexual experience in general. It's so much about vulnerability that even the component of pleasure I think, contributes to that, because it becomes a conversation then about what is or isn't pleasurable. And like you're saying, the goal, if the goal is the pleasure, then the goal is to know that person and right. to know myself and how to share myself.
Right.
And that's about vulnerability, and I think that's a really big part of what you're saying that yeah. sex is for
yeah,
in the context good. Of marriage.
I was telling Gloria on the way over here that I heard you give a talk on this subject over 27 years ago.
Really?
And I'm struck by how much the questions are very similar.
Yeah.
But I won't hold you to anything that you said back then.
Thanks.
You were 14 years old after all, right? I was 6. So. You opened by explaining Paul's comment, all things are lawful, but not everything is profitable.
Uh-huh.
You seem to indicate that some things were profitable for salvation, certain things were profitable for damnation. Do you want to explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think all he really means in the end is just being committed to the things of God, righteousness, goodness, and so on, is profitable for salvation. And to be disregarding those things is unprofitable. It will ultimately, if I really am not committed to those things, I am going to end up damning myself by that. By my contrary commitments. And in this context, he's going on to talk about sexual immorality. So what he's trying to say is not profitable is sexual immorality. Even though it's natural, there's nothing wrong with sex, but the immorality is not profitable. That's the point he's making. And I assume we're all Christians here, right? We can all take it for granted that he's not talking about failure leads to damnation. It's commitment to immorality that leads to damnation. All of us have failure in our lives. We have all been immoral. But what do we do with that? Do we stay committed to it, or do we through our immorality come to develop a taste for goodness and a taste for righteousness and a taste for life? Okay, thanks.